The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And so you have to have the capacity to receive that text message and reply with a verification text of your own. So that's what those SIM banks allow you to do. It allows you to really scale up your operations. And in general, I'd say that that's what I think we were seeing in these documents was the sort of systematizing and making more efficient things that we kind of knew the Russians were doing, so that it was easier for them, so that they could do more of it, so they could be more ambitious in the way they really came after Western targets.
I'm Stephanie Pell, senior editor at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast, April 11th, 2023. Document leaking has been in the news lately, and not just stories about the leaking of U.S. intelligence documents. On March 30th, 2023, The Washington Post published a series of stories about the Vulcan Files, an international investigative project based on thousands of pages of leaked documents from a Russian company that reveal new details about how Russian intelligence agencies seek to operate disinformation campaigns and enhance their ability to launch cyber attacks with the help of contractors. To talk about the Vulcan Files, I sat down with Craig Timberg, senior editor for collaborative investigations at The Washington Post, who, along with his colleague Ellen Nakashima, has bylines on these stories. We talked about how The Washington Post got involved in this investigation, what the documents revealed about Russian cyber conflict, and what Craig considered to be some of the biggest takeaways from the documents. It's the Lawfare podcast, April 11th. Craig Timberg on the Vulcan Files.
Craig, before we get into the substance of the Vulcan Files, can you talk about how the Washington Post became involved in the investigation?
We have a group of partners around the world at other news organizations who we work with fairly regularly. And so one of them, this group of this German group called Paper Trail Media, contacted me, you know, last summer and said, "Hey, we have some really interesting documents that you might want to look at." And I said, "Great." And they said, "But we can't give them to you unless you meet us in Las Vegas." So I flew to Las Vegas. Wow. And they handed me a stick with a bunch of documents on it. And I flew back and started the conversations internally at the Washington Post about whether and how we could be part of this consortium.
So how were the files acquired? And what, if anything, can you tell us about the identity of the leaker or what his or her motivation might have been for leaking the documents?
I mean, to start with the end, we don't know who the leaker is. And nobody who worked on this project knows who the leaker is. One of our partners, one of the German partners, received the documents through an encrypted secure drop and, you know, had conversations with this person through some encrypted chat app. And in those conversations, which now are, you know, were last year, the leaker said, "I'm really concerned about the Russian attack on Ukraine. This company is doing bad things, and I want you to reveal it to the world." I'm paraphrasing there a little bit, but that was the gist of the conversation. And so the German reporter had a few exchanges on this encrypted chat app, and of course was trying to learn more and establish the identity of this person, et cetera. And then this person said, you know, I need to go. It isn't safe anymore. And that was it. That was the last communication we had with this person.
So given that background and the fact that the documents appear to be confidential documents from a Moscow-based cybersecurity contractor, NTC Vulcan, how did the Washington Post or other news organizations go about verifying the authenticity of the documents?
This is kind of a reporting problem from hell when you think about it, right? You have documents that are fascinating and revelatory, but unlike, say, the Pentagon Papers, weren't handed to us directly by somebody we knew. And this is something that happens more and more. All of your major news organizations have secure drops where leakers can just put things in, and you get them and you have to try to make sense of them. What we did in this case was, you know, we spent months and months and months, that's why the story took so long, looking for evidence in the documents that matched evidence in the real world, references to programs, references to individuals. The documents have quite a few references to individuals who we were able to identify, and programs that we were able to identify through other means. But ultimately, we had to share excerpts of the documents with experts who knew something about this company, could read the technical writing in a way that was more illuminating than it was for a bunch of reporters. And then ultimately we had to approach, you know, intelligence agencies and say, do you know this company? Do these documents look real to you? And we had quite a few conversations like that with quite a few intelligence agencies ultimately.
And it sounds like the intelligence agencies were willing to work with you on this, at least to some extent.
Some of them were, to some extent, right? You know, it's not like one can just wander up to these places and call their press line and say, we have a bunch of secret Russian documents. Can you put your stamp of approval on it? I mean, this was an arduous process involving, you know, multiple news organizations over multiple months in multiple countries. And in the end, you know, five Western intelligence agencies looked at them carefully enough and were able to cross-reference material in the documents with other material they had available to them. And they said, yeah, these look real. And then they shared with us some insights about what they thought the various documents meant, what the intentions were. So that was helpful as well. I mean, this stuff is just super rarefied. It's not like, you know, it's not like you can call your average, like, you know, law professor with a background in cyber and say, you know, can you make sense of this stuff? Those documents are not like that.
So I have to ask, because I'm a big Star Trek fan, I noticed that, of course, the word is spelled V-U-L-K-A-N in English, but any thought that this could be an intentional reference by the company to the Vulcans in Star Trek?
You know, it's a great question to which I don't have a great answer, as is oftentimes been the case as we've reviewed these documents, is we're left with questions we can't answer about what the authors intended and by what they said and wrote. And that includes the name Vulcan. Vulcan, I gather, means volcano in Russian. So like it's a word. At the same time, you know, the IT world is very into techie things, including Star Trek, you know, and there are some references in the documents that are, and in sort of ancillary materials that are in the English language. So clearly people spoke English. So I don't know. It's possible.
So can you give us a general sense of the size and scope, meaning the broad topics that this cache of documents covered? And were they all, well, you just kind of answered this question. There were references or some parts that were in English, but were they primarily written in Russian?
They were overwhelmingly in Russian. So there's more than 5,000 pages of documents, and, you know, they're not, unlike the Snowden documents, which I also did at least a little bit of work on, you know, a lot of this stuff was not that clear and easy to make sense of. I mean, you get user manuals, you get training guides, there's contracting documents. In some cases, there's documents that appear more than once with editing notes in it saying, including editing notes that sound a lot like things editors have said to me about my stories over the years. Like, can't we make this clearer? Or can't we just say that? You know, so there's this like funny human quality that's lurking in the documents, but they're overwhelmingly in Russian, you know, and they're not external facing documents by and large. They're trying to, they're, you know, it's like they're, it's technological people speaking with other technological people. And so it made it really hard to make sense of exactly what was going on.
So let's do a deeper dive then into the substance of some of these documents and your investigation. Can you give us a better understanding of exactly who this contractor, NTC Vulcan, appears to be and what it does?
You know, they're a maker of software in Moscow that for some years had, you know, reasonably extensive ties with Western companies, including, you know, Boeing and IBM and Dell, right? They were a vendor. And there's no reason to think any of that work was intelligence work or defense work, but they also had this intelligence and defense side, it seems clear from the documents, where they were making software for, you know, Russian state security services and a sort of affiliated institutes. And so, you know, this is probably not that different from some American companies that do work for our, you know, defense and intelligence agencies, but also have a kind of commercial side as well. And it's, you know, there are quite a few of these companies in Russia. We were told that there probably are dozens of companies that are kind of fit into this category, broadly speaking. This is just the company we happen to have documents from.
And I note in your reporting that you connect Vulcan's work to what is often referred to as Sandworm. Can you tell us what Sandworm is and talk about the significance of this connection?
Sandworm is essentially the most notorious state hacking group in the world. They're the ones who hacked into the, you know, 2018 Olympics opening ceremony. They're the ones who have shut down the power grid in Ukraine a couple of times. They're the ones who released NotPetya, the most economically damaging malware in history. So they're like, they're real A-listers in the hacking world, and every cybersecurity researcher knows them. And I frankly wish we had more from them in particular. What we actually had, there were a couple of references that made us believe that some of the software was developed for Sandworm, if that makes sense. So there, on one of the documents, there's a reference to military unit 74455, which is their, you know, their unit number, and it's, there's a line, you know, approving a particular piece of software. And so like that, you know, that seems pretty direct. And then there's another place in the emails, and the documents include some emails that make it pretty clear that they were visiting Sandworm's headquarters outside of Moscow to sort of demonstrate some of the software. So that gave us, you know, the hard thing about these documents was that, you know, they don't have a lot of contact with real world things like, you know, here's a list of things we want to hack, or here's a list of things we just hacked, or here's where we're going to hack these things. So we were really very eager to try to understand Vulcan's work in the context of things that had really happened in the world and that were observable. And so these references to Sandworm, which were not voluminous, were really helpful in allowing us to understand kind of why Vulcan's work mattered.
So do the documents provide some degree of insight into Russian hacking targets? Like, you know, who Russia was interested in hacking?
Yeah, I mean, they help you understand what was on the minds of people working in this field. And you know, and on some level, you won't be surprised to know that, you know, that when Russians think about hacking external targets, they think about hacking external targets, you know, in the United States and Europe. There is a kind of mock-up of a map that shows the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Switzerland as a kind of like theoretical target. There's on that same page, there's a reference to a nuclear power plant that's also in Switzerland as sort of like a theoretical target. There's another page where you can see an illustration that refers to a place called Fairfield in the United States, but doesn't specify which of the many Fairfields in the United States it was referring to. But we took those references to be more about training and sort of user scenarios as opposed to actual real world targets, which is not to say that, you know, Russian hackers hadn't tried to hack into these places, but we couldn't find definitive evidence that they had. So we had to treat this stuff gingerly. There's another thing like this. There's this map of the United States. This may be my favorite graphic of them all, that has all of these mysterious circles in places, you know, where there's a lot of population centers, but also a lot of internet connections. And So like, right, obviously the Russians think about the United States, but the thing about it that was sort of delightful was that the U.S. states were listed in Russian. Again, not surprising, but you think, oh, right, this is how this looks. This is how our country looks to a Russian hacker.
Sure. And other kinds of insights, you know, big picture that perhaps you were able to learn from the documents, more about Russia's goals or military philosophy. Was any of that kind of information present?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most striking thing here, and this is, again, this for people in the field, this is not exactly surprising, but the Russian military doctrine does not make a meaningful distinction between cyber attacks, meaning sort of hacking into things, and what we call influence operations, which, you know, the efforts to manipulate how the world perceives things. So what the Russian Internet Research Agency did around the 2016 U.S. election, that was an influence operation, right? They formed a bunch of fake accounts, and they praised Donald Trump, and they trashed Hillary Clinton, and they praised Bernie Sanders, et cetera, right? That was an operation intended to influence the U.S. voters. So the Russians think of this as just like another kind of hack. It's like a hack into our brains, if you will. And you can see the sort of porous borders in the way these documents describe things. And there's also a little detail on exactly how, for example, you can make a bunch of fake accounts quickly on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. You could see sort of the toolkit, which is interesting because I've seen a lot of these campaigns taken apart from the outside. You know, researchers try to make sense of like, what are these accounts? Where do they come from? And we always presumed that it worked exactly like this, but it does work exactly as you think. They're sitting at computers, they're making a bunch of fake accounts, they're getting them verified, and then they're putting manipulative stuff up there.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep
acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before DeleteMe started advertising with Lawfare. DeleteMe finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then DeleteMe comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. DeleteMe sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate DeleteMe, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
I appreciate that these are documents from one company, but based on your investigation, how would you characterize the role or significance that private contractors play in Russian offensive cyber operations or cyber conflict?
The contractors are important. And again, this is probably not that different from our analogous U.S. agencies, right? The NSA doesn't make all its own software in-house, I'm guessing. The CIA probably does not make all of its own software in-house. They use contractors. And so the Russians do too. It's more efficient. You have companies that specialize in certain kinds of things. And so it certainly looks like Vulcan is one of a constellation of companies that makes software that makes Russian hacking campaigns work. And you think about like your own place of employment, right? There's at the Washington Post, we have like what we call a content management system, which is where we write and edit stories, but we also have like a payroll system, and we have email. We have, you know, the ability to share documents across different parts of the company. You know, the Russian hacking teams are the same way. It's a lot easier and more efficient for them to just pay other people to make a lot of this more routine software.
So you already noted that you've discovered that there have been some prior connections between Vulcan and Western big tech companies. Was Vulcan on the radar screen, though, do you think of Western governments and these big tech companies as sort of a player assisting the Russian government in its offensive cyber operations or influence operations?
Yes, they were a company on the radar of intelligence agencies and, you know, sort of the most sophisticated cybersecurity companies. But my sense is that nobody knew all that much about them until now. You know, again, we think there's several, maybe dozens of these companies, and Vulcan was one of them. And I think it's clear that the documents that we obtained have sort of significantly expanded, you know, what the world, including probably Western intelligence agencies, know about this particular company. So it was on the radar, but it wasn't like, I never got the sense that this was necessarily a major focus of investigation until now.
Interesting. And in your story, sort of to dig a little deeper again into the contents of the documents, you talk about how the documents shed light on certain projects directed at automated or automating disinformation. Can you talk a bit more about these projects?
There's a project called Amazit, and Amazit seems to have a lot of different parts to it. Like, I mean, I'm not sure we ever got our arms around everything that Amazit did, but since you're asking about disinformation, this is the program where there's sort of step-by-step instructions for basically how to stand up and operate a disinformation campaign. It tells you what kind of hardware and software you need. It tells you, you know, the step-by-step how to create a bunch of fake Facebook accounts. One of my favorite details is, in part because I can visualize, again, I've sort of covered the external manifestations of these things. So sort of seeing it through the eyes of the Russians is interesting. Like, they're sitting there with computers, but also what they call SIM banks. And SIM banks are a piece of hardware you can put a bunch of SIM cards on. You know, SIM cards are what make cell phones work. And so the way what you use SIM cards, SIM banks for is, you know, I'm running some disinformation campaign. I want to create, 3,000 new Facebook accounts. Facebook is going to send out verification texts for each of those accounts. And so you have to have the capacity to receive that text message and reply with a verification text of your own. So that's what those SIM banks allow you to do. It allows you to really scale up your operations. And in general, I'd say that that's what I think we were seeing in these documents, was the sort of systematizing and making more efficient things that we kind of knew the Russians were doing, so that it was easier for them, so that they could do more of it, so they could be more ambitious in the way they really came after Western targets.
So you also talk about in your story the documents providing some insight into Russian efforts to map out critical infrastructure or facilities. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, there's a program called SCAN. One of the things it does is it basically is like scanning the whole world, looking for vulnerabilities. I gather you could aim it at a particular target, but what they're doing is they're identifying and stockpiling the way you could go after targets. So if we use the example of the Swiss nuclear power plant, you don't just, go on the homepage of the Swiss nuclear power plant and start trying to hack into it. You have to evaluate all of their computer systems, and you need to look for vulnerabilities in their computer system that you can exploit. Maybe an old piece of software, maybe a computer that hasn't been kept up to date. And so what SCAN does is evaluates targets and then also evaluates how you could get to those targets if you wanted to hack into them. So it's a kind of a preliminary step. You could think of it as sort of mapping. And so we knew that hackers had software that allowed them to map out vulnerabilities. But here, we're seeing it systematized and automated. And what I'm envisioning is, like, let's say that you wanted to, get into Fort Meade, like the big, U.S. military base in Maryland where NSA and a lot of other things are. You could call up NSA and you could see a bunch of potential vulnerabilities that as a hacker you could later exploit.
Now, as a companion to the big story that you wrote with your colleague Ellen Nakashima, you also wrote a separate story where you discussed some of the key takeaways from the Vulcan files. And I'd like to talk to you about some of the most significant takeaways from your perspective. But before we get to that, do you have a sense of how big a deal this leak was? Perhaps because of its intelligence value, or perhaps because it's a dissension in the ranks, so to speak, and maybe that doesn't normally happen.
I'm embarrassed to say that I don't really know. I mean, Russia has become so walled off from our ability as journalists to observe it. I mean, this, of course, has gotten even worse with the arrest of the Wall Street Journal reporter there. But since the invasion and the buildup of the invasion, it's been extremely hard for the Washington Post and its peers, New York Times and Wall Street Journal, BBC, you name it, like The Guardian, we all are having way more trouble getting into the country, operating safely in the country, talking to people, writing things that might get people thrown in jail. So our insight into that country has radically diminished over the past, year plus since the invasion began. And so I don't actually have a lot of insight into how big of a deal this is in Russia. I presume that, there's some intelligence value, for the Western intelligence agencies that are trying to make sense of Russia as well, but I don't actually know how big it is.
So turning then to the companion article that you wrote, what are some of the most significant takeaways from the Vulcan files for you?
I think the big takeaway is that, this is hard, right? It's hard work, and hacking and building disinformation campaigns. And the Russian security state was looking at how to make it easier, right? They presumably have a finite number of really elite hackers, and they don't want them spending all their time, you know, tooling around, you know, a target, trying to come up with a list of vulnerabilities that they can begin to hack at. They want them sitting on a platter for them. They want a menu of choices just to save everybody time. So again, I feel like we're seeing that hacking is not something that's done on the side or in some basement, but it's part of a large effort that involves public and private entities working together, substantial amounts of money, with the intention of manipulating targets better than they, you know, better than they could otherwise. And that includes disinformation, it includes hacking and surveillance, but it probably also includes some degree of, you know, attacking real-world targets. We see puzzling, but intriguing references to rail lines, seaports, air traffic. These appear to be training documents, but again, you know, like, you know, they're eyeing us, I guess, all the time and trying to figure out what's worth doing and how to do it, and then how to do it as easily as they can. So that's, for me, is the biggest takeaway. It also was sort of fun and revealing to get a little bit of a glimpse of the corporate culture in a Russian, you know, company that does this kind of work. We were able to talk with a small number of former employees who described a kind of pretty happy, you know, kind of like startup-y, you know, workplace, the kind of thing you might find in Silicon Valley. You know, it paid pretty well. They had good tech. There's this one hilarious thing that we found. There's a repository of malware called VirusTotal. It's owned by Google. And in there's a piece of Vulkan malware that we found. We're really excited. Oh, maybe here's the secret, like, cyber weapon we've been looking for. It turns out it was a New Year's Eve invitation. So you, like, downloaded it. It takes you over your computer. It renders a very sort of like pixelated image of a big bear and a champagne bottle and some champagne glasses. And it wishes you a happy new year. And it plays Soviet military music in the background. So I thought, well, this, you know, there's something very clever about it you sort of think, oh, well, there's real people behind this, right? There's like humans who are doing this work. And some of the time they need diversions, just like all of us do.
So I have to note, though, too, that you, in the companion piece you wrote, you talk about essentially that, you know, war has consequences. And I think you were getting at least what you and your colleagues doing this reporting in various news organizations learned about the motivation of the leaker, what he or she at least was willing to tell you.
Yeah, there's been a few leaks now out of Russia since the invasion. It's clear, you know, the IT economy in Russia has been really hurt badly by the reaction to the invasion. Lots and lots and lots of people working at companies have fled to other parts of the world. Some of them are really alienated. Maybe they thought they were doing patriotic work and now are realizing that they're contributing to this, you know, this terrible thing, these terrible things that are happening in Ukraine. And some of them clearly are using their skills to hurt Russian companies and the Russian state. So I guess our point is that, you know, when you take your country to war, there are lots of unintended consequences that come with that. And this leak appears to be one of them.
So is this an ongoing investigation? Might we expect more stories from either the Washington Post or some of your other news outlet partners?
I'd say maybe. When we put a lot of work into that, and some of our partners did multiple stories. So if you happen to read German, the Germans who got the original leak have did a whole mess of stories in a video and a podcast. And so there's already a lot more stuff out there for people who have the ability to access it. I think we would like to do more on this, but we'd have to find something new and revelatory to publish a new story. But I think we're all ears. I mean, we'd like to keep pulling back the veil if we could.
And I presume it's difficult to know, but if there is any fallout from this story in Russia, it'd be very interesting to learn about.
Well, precisely, right? I mean, if there was fallout that we were able to perceive from here, we would write about that.
Sure. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners that perhaps we haven't touched upon?
You know, I guess it may be obvious, but maybe it's not, that this is not the kind of thing even a big high-powered news organization like the Washington Post could have easily done on its own. I mean, the reason why we enter into these collaborations is really twofold. One, it gets us access to material we wouldn't otherwise get. So this landed with some Germans who happened to like us enough to invite us in. So it was nice to be part of this as opposed to just reading about it later. But the other thing is, you know, when we team up with other news organizations, you know, they have sources we don't have and we have sources they don't have. And so, you know, we started with the question of like, how do you verify documents whose origin you can't verify? And having a bunch of reporters in a bunch of different countries who are really good at what they do, that have sources all over the world, made this work much easier and more powerful than it possibly could have been if only one news organization had done on its own. So I think it's these big collaborations, these sort of multi-nation international collaborations, are kind of a newish thing. But man, when they work, they're a beautiful thing. You can just do reporting that you really couldn't do any other way. And I was really glad to be part of this, and I was glad to have contributed to the, you know, this multinational effort to learn what we could about this company.
So I would note that you are the senior editor for collaborative investigations at the Washington Post, and you've been a part of other collaborative investigations. It sounds like this one worked really well and sort of advanced the ball on the model. Am I reading too much into your comments?
You know, all of them have worked pretty well. This was a much harder story than some of the others we've done, just because the target was so difficult. I mean, a company we didn't really know in a place we don't have that much access to, with very high stakes for correctness and thoroughness and not misinterpreting things. And so I'd say, you know, I've done some complicated stuff in my career, including the Pegasus project a couple of years ago, which was another one of these big international consortiums that was about surveillance software. I think this was the hardest we've done so far. And I think, you know, both of those are just a real vindication of a model that we didn't even try to do 10 years ago. I've been with the Post a long time. And I think if earlier in my career, if someone said, here, we've got a bunch of documents in Russian, and the leaker is anonymous, and you know, we have no idea how we're going to verify, I don't think we would have done this story. It was because of our ability to make these sorts of partnerships and the comfort we've gotten with our very high quality partners around the world that made us feel like this was a target we could take on. And that's an important thing.
Well, I think that's a good note to leave it there for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.